Good morning, everyone. Welcome. It's good to be with you again. It's been 2 weeks since we were together in this class. For that reason, we'll take just a minute and review some of the things we've been talking about in terms of Christian evidences. But again, it is good to be with you and to have this chance to study together. We've been pointing out the following three barriers that atheism has to climb in order to justify itself. To be an atheist, you have to somehow explain how it is that something came from nothing, how it is that life came from non-life, how it is that once life existed, simple life, complex life was able to spontaneously, without direction, come on the scene. And that is what the theory of evolution purports to do. How is it that we went from simple life to complex life? And that's where we are right now. We want to make two main points as we study the theory of evolution. The purpose of our study is to remove some of the intimidation and the fear that we have maybe of modern science by studying it and looking at the question of whether or not it's adequate as an explanation. Is it able to do what it purports to do in explaining this progression from simple life to complex life? And the answer that comes to us on investigation is a resounding no. But we want to look at two fundamental problems. But let's just briefly remind ourselves what the mechanism for evolution is, or the mechanism of evolution. So there are two central components, and they involve variation in the first place. So variation comes about as a result of mutation occurring in the DNA. The DNA molecule, as it's being duplicated, there is some mutation that occurs, and that gives a variation in the resulting organism. And once that new organism is on the scene, it is either more fit or less fit, the theory goes. And then in consequence, if it is more fit, it is more likely to survive, to pass on its particular set of instructions or particular DNA. If it's less fit, it will in the extreme die off right away, or more likely not be able to produce as much progeny, say. And that's the essential mechanism of variation. So there's of evolution. There's variation among organisms, and then the most fit of the organisms are selected for. Okay, and we've talked about that now for a week or two, so we won't spend too much time on that. But I'll look at these following two fundamental problems with the theory of evolution. And these objections are central in the sense that there has been no real answer to them from the scientific community. These things are largely ignored and glossed over, and we are just asked to accept them, but we want to spend a little time investigating them. The first one is that the nature of this system of mutation and subsequent selection, mutation selection, is inadequate to generate new useful variations. So mutations are not adequate to produce new information, new functional information on which evolution can be expected to progress. Secondly, the variations which could potentially lead to new useful information are unselectable. And we'll say what we mean by that in a minute. But so we'll start with the first of these. Mutations are unable to produce new useful information. Okay? We've talked about this already a little bit. Two weeks ago, we studied this in a little bit of detail, so we won't spend as much time on this first point. But let me just remind you of a couple of things. First of all, mutations are extraordinarily rare, and there are different estimates as to how often it is in the process of copying a DNA molecule that a mistake is made. How often does a mistake occur? The estimates range from something like 1 in 10 million letters in the DNA code to something like 1 in a billion letters in the DNA code. So copying is being done, Occasionally a mistake is made, an error is made, but they are extraordinarily rare. In other words, the copying mechanisms in place are extraordinarily reliable. And so mutations, therefore, are rare. They don't happen all that often. But when they do happen, the distribution of the mutations that occur is almost always one-sided, completely on the harmful side, or at the best, you might say it's neutral. So the mutations that do occur are deleterious or harmful, have a negative effect on the organism's ability to survive, or maybe it is neutral. We talked 2 weeks ago in some detail about what happens when you have a complex system with coordinated parts where one part of the system affects many or maybe all of the other parts of the system. What happens whenever things are randomly jiggled or randomly changed? And we said that almost always produces a negative, harmful, deleterious effect for the system. And the best analogies we have, I think, are the following, something like the following. You might imagine a book, even a novel, that you would buy just for the pleasure of reading. Maybe it contains little historical information, but it's a good story, a fun story to read. In such a situation, if a random change is made, if letters are changed randomly, not with intelligence, but randomly changed, the book will not be as good. It will lose some of its quality. If chapters are duplicated, if paragraphs are duplicated, you read a paragraph and then you read the same paragraph again, that would be a harmful consequence, harmful effect to the book. You might say, if you're trying to compare this to the variation natural selection system, you might say the book is less likely to sell. It's less likely to be selected in the market, you might say. But so random changes to a book is, you could think of as a highly complex, highly coordinated system of ideas and words and sentences and so forth and organization. Random changes are bad. Instruction manuals have the same property. They have to communicate information. They have to have functional information that's useful to producing some result. Random changes to instruction manuals, and we looked last time at the example of the wagon, an instruction manual for the wagon, and we talked about how random changes to an instruction manual will be, in general, either somewhere on the range from devastating to neutral or nearly neutral. You can imagine producing a wagon where the instruction manual is changed in such a way that now it has only three wheels. For some reason, the fourth wheel is missing. That wagon will not sell, would not be selected. And that's something of an analogy for the kinds of things that happen when you make any random change in a complex system. I think personally the best example, at least the best example that I know of, is of a computer program, which again is a highly specific code that has to be read letter by letter by a compiler, and if there is any mistake in the code, any change to the code, certainly of a random nature, will negatively affect the way the program works, what the program is able to accomplish. And so in these complex systems, there is almost always negative result to any random change. Any change that does occur, and you can imagine intelligently making changes. If I took a book, maybe it's possible I could make a change to the book that would improve it. But that's on the basis of an intelligence being inserted into the system. So I have to understand the parts, understand the story, first of all. I have to understand how the English language works and how a change would fit into the rest of the story so that I can't have something happening in chapter one that contradicts something that happens later. And so that involves intelligence. Any change must be carefully coordinated. Any change to information, structurally complex information, has to be highly coordinated to be beneficial. So mutations are very rare. Bringing this back to the system of life, we talked about the highly coordinated nature of systems in even at the cellular level. Our bodies consist of trillions, multiplied trillions of cells which have to interact, have different purposes and different functions. But even within a single cell, the processes that are involved, the chemical pathways and processes, are incredibly highly arranged. And I feel like I've said that same sentence about 8 times since we've been studying together, but I don't think this point can be overemphasized. The coordination involved in such a system is incredible, so that random changes are somewhere between deadly and maybe neutral. Here was our wagon example. If you imagine this is a piece of a piece of the instruction manual, part of the instruction manual, imagine changing in one of the underlined positions randomly the information. So instead of 38.5 inches, you change to 38.9 inches. Maybe that's a relatively small change. Maybe it's conceivably even something of an improvement. But what if we go from 12.2 inches wide in this wagon? Remember, the 12.2 inches wide piece of metal here has to be coordinated with the rest of the dimensions, the other dimensions of the wagon. If we go from 12.2 to 32.2, if that one were to change to a 3, what kind of effect would that have? What if instead of inches, this now read feet or something absurd like that? And so it's clear that small changes to specified information that has to interact with the natural world are bad. And furthermore, this is, by the way, not my analogy. This red wagon example comes from John Sanford in a book called Genetic Entropy. But imagine that by such changes, such random changes, we must go from a red wagon to something like a space shuttle or something with tremendously more, much more complexity and additional functions that a wagon does not have. The sorts of responses that the evolutionist might make to such statements. I mean, what would an evolutionist would not be silent if they were in this audience? Okay, at least typically would not. They would, maybe they wouldn't say something publicly, but they would have something to say. Okay, there would be a response that would be made. What kinds of things might be said? Now, I want to get on to that second point, the second fundamental issue, quickly. But I just want to think perhaps about what might be the response from someone who is not in agreement with what we've been saying. Someone asked me a couple of weeks ago about why it is, someone in this audience asked about why it is that evolutionists, atheists, okay, talk about millions or billions of years. What is the preoccupation with millions and billions of years? In my mind, this is something like what you do when you don't like the way something appears and you squint your eyes and try to imagine it being in some other way. Millions and billions of years are absolutely required. They're absolutely necessary, not sufficient, but they're absolutely necessary for the generation, the gradual generation of more complex life. In other words, evolution has to have time to do stuff. So it's almost like we're going to give it a period of time that's greater than anything we have familiarity with. I'm going to talk not about hundreds of years, because I can imagine hundreds of years. I can imagine maybe thousands of years. At least thousands of years are included in recorded human history. So we can talk about the time of, say, the ancient Romans, and we can in biblical times and so forth within the context of thousands of years. But millions of years? That's a long time. That's a long time. Billions of years, 1,000 million years is a billion years. That's a period of time that almost doesn't fit in our minds, and so that seems to maybe accomplish something. Okay, just by virtue of the fact that we can't really wrap our minds clearly around such enormous amounts of time. So it's like we're squinting our eyes. But a point that needs to be made here about time is that time is not enough. Time doesn't do it. The bacteria E. coli, for example, has been continuously grown in a flask for at least 30,000 generations. Maybe by this point in time, something like 35 generations. E. coli reproduces itself, copies its DNA something like 7 times in a 24-hour period. So it can go through several life cycles every day. And so you have multiple generations that you can submit to different pressures and different environments and look at and study what sorts of evolution they're able to go through. The fact that millions and billions of years are discussed really is irrelevant. In the last, let's say, 30 years, we've had 30,000 or more generations of this bacteria reproducing itself, and nothing has appeared. Not just nothing, but more can even be said about that. But no productive evolution has occurred. We squint our eyes and we think about wet, muddy pools in a rainforest somewhere far away, and we imagine, because of just the nature of that scenario, the way it feels to our minds, that maybe something new can happen. Some new biological feature will develop because of the heat or the wetness, or the maybe lightning is going to strike and impart energy to the system, and now there will be something happening. Those are very imprecise thoughts, though. Very imprecise, and they don't address numbers, they don't address probabilities, they don't address the sorts of things you'd have to give anything like a real explanation for evolutionary progress. We must look clearly at the issue and understand it in a detailed way. An objection that might be made, moving on, by an evolutionist who were listening to these things is the objection of similarity. That is, when you look around at the living realm, when we look at life, there is a remarkable amount of similarity from one organism to the next. This appears in body plans. The body plan of a cat is not unlike the body plan of a dog. If you squint your eyes just a little bit, you might confuse the one for the other. A cat has two forelegs and two hind legs. The locomotion is roughly the same. They walk on opposite legs. Both of them do. They have a tail, something like a tail, so you can see the homology from one to the other. They both have a head at the front. They have ears that stick up a bit. And so there is undeniably similarity between cats and dogs. And the argument, though, the underlying assumption, is that similarity implies a developmental relationship. In other words, the argument is the only way these two organisms could be as similar as they are is if they had a common ancestor sometime back in their evolutionary past. But if you think about that, that's not really an argument. That's actually an assumption. The assumption is that if they're similar, then they must have come from the same source. That's not an argument for that being the case. All life has DNA. Therefore, there must be a common ancestor that started with the original DNA and then diversified from there. Monkeys and humans have opposing thumbs. Therefore, there must be a common ancestor. Is that an argument or an assumption? Any similarity body plans we've already mentioned, we started with that one, implies a common ancestor. I submit to you, though, again, that that's not an argument. That is an assumption. Is the assumption, though, a valid assumption? Is it valid? Does similarity imply a common ancestor? Just on principle, on logical principle, is that implication correct? Why is it not better? And this is a question that has to be answered. Why is it not better explained by a common designer? That is, why couldn't a common designer look at the available options for life on this planet and these environments and these scenarios and decide to use similar designs, common designs, across various organisms? Why is that not reasonable? Why is that not a better explanation than the original? Why couldn't the designer select the same design multiple times for multiple uses? That's a perfectly valid question, and it has to be answered. Why is one answer, why is one explanation better than the other? Think about some of the analogies that we have in this arena. You could imagine different automakers. For example, a Chevrolet and a Toyota, okay, or a Chevrolet and a Ford. So you have multiple automakers, but both of these cars have four wheels. They both have steering wheels. They both have seats that are adjustable. They both have an engine in the front. There's a lot of homology from one to the other, but does that imply that a Chevrolet evolved into a Toyota? Or does it involve the fact that intelligence was involved in both designs and among the available options, the same one was selected. Just because there is similarity, that does not imply common ancestry. Same thing is true with computers. Computers have a screen that's forward-facing. Often they're lifted up off of the desk a bit with some kind of a support. They have keyboards connected by wires. Does that imply a common ancestor, or does that imply common design to serve comparable purposes, similar purposes? And so it's not at all the case that similarity should be best explained or is best explained by common ancestry. Any questions or comments about that thought before we move on? Questions? Okay. Another objection that could be made, and again, this is an indirect objection, but it's there, and it constitutes an objection. The objection being that there are lots of examples of evolution occurring. Lots of examples out there where organisms change. Notably, what about antibiotic resistance? This is in the news almost on a weekly basis, that some antibiotic that once was effective, once was useful, is no longer useful. And there are many, many other examples. In the realm of population genetics, studies of fruit flies, the E. coli that we mentioned a minute ago, and other somewhat simple organisms are studied in detail. And lots of generations of these organisms are investigated, and then they look for some change that appears in the organism. Is that an example of evolution? More specifically, is that an example, are these examples of the sort of changes, the sort of evolution, that word is so squishy, I almost hate to use it, but the sort of changes that would be necessary to produce new functional information, new information that could serve different function in life. When we look at in a little more detail at these examples, and we won't spend too much time with them, but the sort of change that we're seeing in all of these examples is what you might describe as trench warfare or the burning of bridges, crops, and supplies to get a little bit of advantage between competing species. And let me say something about that. So in his book, I meant to bring this book with me. I forgot. I brought another book with me that I'll show you in a minute. But in his book, Edge of Evolution, this is his second major book, Michael Behe discusses the competition between malaria and sickle cell anemia. So if you're not familiar with it, like I wasn't that familiar with it before I read the book, sickle cell anemia is a disease that affects the hemoglobin. We've talked about hemoglobin in this class before. In an affected person, the hemoglobin has been mutated in one position, and that changes the shape of the red blood cell. So the red blood cell now has a crescent shape or a moon shape or a sickle shape to it, and that makes it less able to flow smoothly through the capillaries and arteries and veins in the affected person. So the anemia comes about because of this misshapen red blood cell. Sickle cell anemia is always harmful to the person who is so affected. They have shortened lifespan, significantly shortened lifespan. In the case where both parents have the sickle mutation, their lifespan is less than 10 years, expected lifespan. In the case of a person who has a single parent with the sickle mutation, they will live longer, but not much longer. With modern medicine, more so, but it is unquestionably a harmful condition to have. What does this have to do with malaria? Well, in Africa, particularly, where malaria is present, it may come in and affect large fractions of the population. A large fraction of the population may be killed off by the disease, in particular in third world settings, and so malaria is devastating, but it doesn't affect a person with the sickle mutation nearly as badly. So a person with sickle cell anemia is sometimes entirely immune to malaria, and so will survive an outbreak of that scourge of a disease. And so what's going on there? You have a human being with a mutation in the DNA that codes for the hemoglobin protein in their red blood cells. That causes a harmful effect. It makes them weaker. It causes complications all over the board that they will deal with their entire life. But it enables them to survive malaria, because malaria parasite, the bacteria, is not able to attack this misshapen blood cell. And so it's ineffective in its attack, in its warfare against its human host. And so you have a weakened human who is able to survive what would otherwise be to them very likely deadly. Is that a benefit? Is that evolution? Have we moved forward or progressed in any real way? Well, not at all. Certainly not. The reason that the individual is able to survive the malaria is because of one of the parts of their system being broken, so that now the malaria cannot attack their system, cannot gain the upper hand. And that's the sort of thing we see across the board. The same is true with antibiotic resistance. Antibiotic resistance does not result in any known case. It never results from a new functional adaptation or evolution that the bacteria has undergone or the virus has undergone. It always results, in every known case, it results from the breaking of some biological function, a mutation that causes a breaking of something that otherwise is properly working that now makes the antibiotic ineffective against the bacteria. So some functioning part of the bacteria breaks so that now the antibiotic agent is not able to harm it. That's exactly what we see in all examples of antibiotic resistance. The same sort of thing can be said about fruit flies. So you get some interesting looking new fruit fly, for example. They can be bred with more than two wings, but that is not an improvement. There's no manifest new information. That's not an improvement, and it is actually harmful to the organism. So it's reasonable then, and if you're interested in these things more, I highly recommend Michael Behe's book, Edge of Evolution, because he goes into these matters in much more detail and describes what we know about change, adaptation, and evolution, if you want to use that word. He describes it as trench warfare. The way one organism gets an upper hand over another one is by breaking something of its own, burning something, some of its own function, figuratively speaking, so that the antagonist is not able to have its desired effect. So these are two fundamental problems that we're studying. We've been looking at some objections. We've studied now how the fact that evolution, mutation, cannot generate new useful information, new variations. We want to look now at this second point, the second issue. The second issue is that variations which could lead to new useful or usable information are too small to be detected. And I want to use an analogy here that I borrowed from John Sanford's book, Genetic Entropy, which I highly recommend you look at. And it just so happened, as we were talking on the way here in the car this morning about this analogy, the analogy is based on the story of the princess and the pea. Do you know that story, anybody? The princess and the pea. And I don't think I knew the story before I read this book. But it just so happened, Angela said, Ava has that book in the back seat right now. And so here it is. I'll bring it in and then show it. So The Princess and the Pea is a story that has to do with a highly refined young lady who is so sensitive to her environment that she can detect a pea, like a pea that you would eat, underneath of dozens of mattresses. Okay, so she not only under a single mattress can she feel that the discomfort from this little object, this little pebble-sized pea. But even if you stack the mattresses, these soft mattresses up on top of it, she's so sensitive that she can detect, being a princess and perfect in every way there, she can detect a pea all the way down underneath of these mattresses. There's an analogy here for the issue involved in selecting for a mutation. That is, mutations are only selectable by natural selection in the environment. Okay, an organism is only selected if the mutation is sufficiently intense, or it causes a sufficiently and adequately significant change in the organism. And there's a positive and a negative side to this. Beneficial mutations, if they're too smallly beneficial, will not be preserved. So you could imagine there is some mutation that occurs that could lead to positive, useful progression, a positive, useful change in the organism. But if it's not significant enough, it's like you could imagine the pea is hidden under 13 mattresses or something like this, and so cannot be felt by natural selection, cannot be preserved. Maybe objectively it would be useful, but it cannot be selected for. And on the other hand, harmful mutations that should be eliminated, that have a negative impact on the organism, are not removed by this process, again, because it cannot be felt through the layers of mattresses. The change is so small, a single change in DNA may be so small that it cannot be detected. Good ones are not kept, and bad ones are not removed. Okay, and this point is made very well in this book. And if you're interested, I do have a copy of it. You're more than welcome to take a look at it. So here's a picture of what's going on, and we saw this picture before. This is something like a distribution of the effect of mutations versus their frequency. On the right-hand side, you have positive mutations, beneficial mutations, and we've already said what happens when you make random change in complex systems. The change is almost always deleterious. And so that's why there's nothing shown over there on the right. This curve normally would continue in a symmetric way from left to right, but because of the fact that mutations are almost always harmful, the distribution looks something like this, okay? On the left-hand side, you have the negative or deleterious mutations. Most of them are nearly neutral. Neutral would be right in the middle, but some of them out on the tail on the left are highly negative, highly deleterious, and cause great harm to the organism. Most of them, though, are neutral. But here's what we're saying in this second point. There's a region of selectability for these mutations. In other words, again, a mutation has to be sufficiently positive or sufficiently negative to be selected. So you can imagine these rectangles are like the boxes in which you must be in order to be selected. If you are too close there to the middle, okay, the organism will not be selected. Okay, it doesn't provide enough benefit to even be felt by natural selection. So we could only select things over here and over here. The things in the middle, the majority in the middle, are not even selectable. And this point, again, is made clearly in the text of that book. Are there any questions before we move on? So those are the two points we wanted to look at. The fact that the variation that we see from random mutation is not adequate, it does not produce new functional information, and also the fact that the mutations that do appear are not selectable. Any questions or thoughts about that? Anyone?
So the main mechanism of evolution is mutations to get things better and better for the survival of the fittest, but it just doesn't work that way in reality, is what you're saying.
That's right, yes. Yeah. It doesn't work that way. Very good. Questions or thoughts? Again, thank you for your patience as we've gone through all of those things. There's a lot of details there that maybe are obscure to us, but hopefully that has been worthwhile to us. There are outlines available in the back, by the way, that you can pick up and take one with you if you so choose. Okay, so I want to move on from this idea now back towards the Bible and to think about evolution in the context of the Bible just briefly, and we won't spend much time with this, but We need to make the point that evolution is incompatible or contrary to, incompatible with the teaching of the Bible. That is, there is not any harmony between the sorts of things we mean when we talk about evolution and Bible teaching, plain Bible teaching. The starting point for this, I think, is the Genesis account. It has to be the Genesis account of creation. And the fact that that account is straightforward in its presentation. In the presentation of the text, we have a straightforward discussion, description of creation. The standard answer, or a common answer, to evolution by theists even, is that the Genesis account and the biblical account in general can be interpreted as compatible with the theory of evolution. You may have heard the term theistic evolution, which would indicate that you are a theist, that is, you believe in God, but at the same time you accept the basic tenets of the theory of evolution. In other words, you believe that in that process from simple life to complex life, essentially, evolution is responsible. Now, there's a spectrum between what you might call creationist perspective and theistic evolution perspective. Some on the theistic evolution side, in the extreme, might say that God created, say, the first single-celled life, and then from that point on, it evolved naturally by itself into all the diversity that we see today. A less extreme theistic evolutionary position would be something like, at important points along the evolutionary development, God inserted himself and input new information, say, into the DNA and helped the process along, not just by the creation of the singular celled organism at the beginning, but at several points along the way. And so there's a spectrum of options here that need to be addressed, should be addressed. And we just want to say briefly a positive statement about how the Bible approaches these things. Again, the Genesis account is straightforward, and there is no reason in the text to take it in any way but as a literal description. If you would, turn in your Bible to 1 Timothy chapter 2 and have that ready. 1 Timothy chapter 2. The context for this passage has to do with general teaching. Paul says in verse 1, he's talking about prayers being made for those who are in authority, kings all in authority. He goes on to teaching about men and women, their relationship, their behavior in the congregation, down through chapter 2. And I think about Paul in the context of his knowledge of the Old Testament, his understanding of the Old Covenant. One of the most impressive evidences to me of the veracity of the story of Jesus generally is the fact that Paul, with the Old Testament in his head at all times, given his level of study, his level of understanding, his level of scholarship, having the Old Testament in his mind, in his heart, understanding its implications, the interrelations of its various parts, but nonetheless, or I should say, because of that, being convinced that the story of Jesus is correct. In particular, being convinced the story of Jesus is compatible with that Old Testament system of doing things. That's an incredible piece of evidence for the truth of Christianity, at least to my mind. But Paul, who had the Old Testament in his mind, understood the book of Genesis better than I ever will, better than any of us perhaps ever will, said the following about Genesis chapter 1, Genesis chapter 2. So take a look down in verse 13. He's talking about relationship between men and women, interaction in the congregation. He says in verse 13, "For Adam was formed first, and then Eve. Adam was formed first and then Eve. That's referenced back to the book of Genesis, first chapters, and he's talking about a literal understanding of those passages. If Paul, I guess the argument would go, viewed those passages in a direct, straightforward way, and who was inspired, not to mention had the Old Testament in his mind at all times, then how could I ever view it in any other way? Adam was formed first, and then Eve. Adam was not deceived. Woman was deceived, fell into transgression. So again, he's referring back to those early chapters of the book of Genesis, and he is drawing conclusion that they are literally as written, in a straightforward way, true, descriptive, specific, and descriptive of a reality, as opposed to being figurative or something that is open to a broad interpretation into which maybe millions or billions of years could be fit. And so Paul viewed this these first chapters as literal and valid. Jesus did the same thing. Jesus did the same thing in Matthew chapter 19. And we could turn over there. We're running short on time. But in Matthew chapter 19, Jesus refers back to the beginning and how God made them male and female and how he intended for the man to leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, and he goes on there and discusses a literal view of those first chapters of the book of Genesis. In the in Exodus chapter 20, when we have the Ten Commandments being given early on, there is a discussion of the Sabbath, and it is said there. And again, we're running out of time. We could look at the reference. It said that in 6 days God created the heavens and the earth. I'm paraphrasing, and then rested on the seventh day. On the basis of that, we have the Sabbath. And so, how could it be that these writers are giving us a fundamental, literal understanding of those first chapters of Genesis, and we would take them in any other way? Efforts to impose millions and billions of years into those first, into the first chapter of the book of Genesis, are not valid. Any questions or thoughts about that? Questions? Okay, so we're almost out of time. I'm going to stop there, and we will pick up next week with a discussion of the moral argument for the existence of God. This wraps up our study of the teleological argument, and next week we will begin the moral argument. Thank you very much.